The way that you work out, the way that you coach clients to work out, tells a story about what you're trying to accomplish, what you learned, and how you decided to do what you decided to do. What story are your workouts telling about you? What story are they telling about your clients? What's up, Active Lifers? Welcome back to the Active Life Podcast. I'm Dr. Sean Pastuch. I'm your host. I'm joined in studio today by my friend, Josh Clay. Josh and I dive into all kinds of stuff on this podcast about learning how to communicate better, about what it's like to come from nothing and make something of yourself and decide money's actually a good thing and I can do some good stuff with it, all the way into what your program design look like. You're going to find a lot of nuggets in this podcast, whether they're about personal communication or exercise. I'm excited to hear what they are. Make sure you hop into my DM and let me know. Let's get to the show.
Gave you a shout out because I was like, you know, somebody, I was like, Sean owns Active Life. And I was like, he said something when I met with him the other day, and I keep saying it over and over. I'm like, everybody wants to be an athlete, but everybody wants to be athletic. Mm-hmm. And they're like, that's awesome. And I was like, yeah. So I was trying to, you know, jam on what my approach was. And I was like, I didn't say your last name because I was like, I can't remember. I'm going to fucking butcher this. Okay. And I wanted to say Patush. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's 100% not it. I was like,
Sean, even if that was it, I would change it.
Yeah, I was like, Sean at Active Life. Mm-hmm. I was like, he said that. And I was like, no. So I've been like telling a lot of people that because.
Well, you got to run with it and make it yours before someone else hears it and makes it theirs.
I know. And even I told my assistant today because we had a branding workshop.
With who?
Well, just her and I.
Okay.
Just like trying, just jamming out on some of my social. And she was like, oh, wow. I really like that. I was like, exactly. I was like, so if we can have something that kind of riffs off of that, I was like, then we can really start to attract the ideal avatar. Because I don't know if you saw it, but her and I chatted after you and I met. And now we're just challenger strength, like taking that. Like, let's just go to our end user. And my fucking engagement is through the roof right now.
Well, let's just keep this in the podcast and talk to me about, like, I want to hear more about it.
Yeah.
For those of you who missed the intro, Josh Clay, welcome to the Active Life Podcast.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you.
So what did you change? What did you change about your social content that's driven your engagement up specifically?
We simplified it. Honestly, we simplified it. Instead of just talking to coaches and trainers, now we're talking to my ideal client avatar, right? Which is these people, like you said, who everybody wants to be an athlete, or not everyone wants to be an athlete, but everyone wants to be athletic. Mm-hmm. So those people, they probably played sports when they were younger. They're not looking to be an athlete, but they still want to be able to do some of those things, build muscle, lose fat. So what I was doing before is I was trying to use my business Instagram to talk to them, mm-hmm. and my personal brand and Instagram to talk to coaches and trainers. But it was just spreading me too thin.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it was just a lot. I couldn't take it on. And these days, people don't want to connect with brands so much as they want to connect with people. Mm-hmm. And now what we did is I took, when you and I met, I was probably mid taking like a full month off of social media in terms of just not posting at all. I was just burnt out. I also, one of my beliefs when it comes to programming is random workouts get random results. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that that same concept also applied to social media. Random posts get random results. So the reason I was overwhelmed is because I was posting out of a feeling of necessity, like I have to do this, but I wasn't being super strategic. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting how so much of the stuff that I teach in program design applies to business and applies to life and applies to social media. So now we actually have, you know, I'm big on systems. I very much believe in systems, but I believe that systems should be built on principles. So her and I sat down, huge brainstorm, got on Canva and created our whole social media system. Like, what are the types of posts we are going to have? When we create these type of posts, what is the goal of these posts? Are we looking to intrigue people, like challenge their commonly held beliefs? Mm-hmm. Are we looking to give them an exercise? Are we looking to give them a workout for providing value? Are we looking to connect with them in terms of creating depth and giving them a glimpse into my thoughts and my personal life? But now I know exactly, we even got crystal clear on my ideal client avatar. You know what I mean? Like, how old are they? And it's interesting because I hired a branding expert Boris, he owns Metcon Creative.
I know Boris.
Yeah, so Boris and I work together.
I was going to recommend Boris if you haven't worked with somebody.
Yeah, so Boris and I work together, but it's interesting because my client avatar has kind of evolved a little bit since him and I finished up. Mm-hmm. So we had to kind of change things massage it a little bit. And now instead of talking to coaches and trainers, it's super relieving because I'm not as overwhelmed. And when it comes to talking coaches and trainers, the post and some of that stuff can sometimes take a little longer to write, like captions and stuff, and just forming the content. Now it's just super simple. And what's interesting is now coaches and trainers are vibing with my content.
Talked about that.
Yeah, are vibing with my content more than when I was using, you know, lengthy words and, you know, little things like that. Like not saying rate of force production, like it's power. Like not saying for it's strength, right? Like just simplifying it because I know how I am. Like, and I was having this thought the other day is I do believe that our attention spans have shortened, but I also think that most people don't know how to write. Like we add a ton of fluff, we fluff it up instead of just stripping it down to what is the primary takeaway from this and what are the primary supporting details that we need to support this takeaway instead of just a ton of fluff. And like, so it's twofold. Yeah, our attention spans have decreased, but also people don't know how to, I don't want to read your captions because I don't care about the reading all the fluff. Just tell me what is the primary thing you're trying to communicate to me.
Yeah, my attention span's fine. Your writing sucks.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's quite literally it.
Well, I talked about this on my social media this weekend and it was a total, like it was a joke, but it wasn't. I walked downstairs. I told my wife, I'm like, you look especially beautiful this morning. And I meant it. I'm like, you look especially beautiful this morning. I don't know what it is, but you do. And she's like, that's because I fell asleep in my makeup last night. So anyway, the nickname for that right now is Krusty Kim. Because my friend texted me and she's like, Asia says this to me every time I wake up in the morning with my makeup on. He's like, I love Leftover Leah. And I was like, Leftover Leah, it's going to be Krusty Kim. I like that. And so my wife likes it. But she went to her Instagram and she wrote this caption, or she says this caption. She's like, she just added 17 words that I didn't say.
Yeah.
And I was like, I posted that to my story and I said, you all know me.
Yeah.
I would never use this atrocious English. This is offensive to the language. Like this is a Maryland education right here.
Yeah.
So it's the same in everything. It's like, get to the point. What are you trying to say? Use fewer words. Do you know who Evie Pamporis is?
What is it?
Do you know who Evie Pamporis is?
No.
She was a Secret Service agent, and she wrote the book Becoming Bulletproof, which is about keeping yourself safe, keeping yourself effective as a communicator and all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And in the book, one of the things she talks about is stop dropping $1 bills with your communication.
Yeah.
Start dropping hundreds. You're going to have fewer hundreds. But if everywhere you go, you're just dropping dollars, single dollar bills everywhere you go, no one's going to ever stop and walk. Like no one's going to want to walk behind you on the chance that it's worth picking up what you drop.
Yeah.
But if you would just shut the fuck up and only drop hundreds.
Yeah.
Everybody would follow your lead. It doesn't matter what we're talking about.
That's interesting. Cause from a coaching standpoint, my thing is if it can be said in two words, don't say it in four. Mm-hmm. Rate of force production. It's power.
Right.
Force production. It's strength. Mm-hmm. Like, right, so often, especially with training and coaching, and I firmly believe, it's interesting, I'm reading a book right now on writing, and they talk about write like you would talk. But the problem is, now some of us are starting to talk like we write in terms of...
No cap.
Yeah, right? Well, that, and then
the fuck it, that
we, we're just, we're making things more complicated than it needs to be. Like, just get to the fucking point. What are you trying to say? What do you want me to do? Mm-hmm. And I think it was, President Eisenhower used to have somebody that would controlled what messages ended up on his desk.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it might have been President Eisenhower. I can't remember, but controlled had his assistant or secretary, whoever it was, basically go through and decide what was worth his time. And that's I think that's an interesting take in terms of I have specific individuals where I follow them, I add them to my starred list on Instagram, to your point, because I know that when they release information, it's going to be something that I want to consume. Mm-hmm. It's going to be something that's going to help move the needle. And that's one thing that I'm really trying to do with my social media content, is not just post to post, but deliver content that's actionable, that people can actually use right away and apply to their workouts, or that coaches can apply to their approach, or whatever that may be. Is just giving actual actionable advice.
Well, I think a good lesson that people should be able to take from this already is, you came out here a few weeks ago just for a hang. We talked. I wasn't giving you business advice. We were just talking. And you heard something that you thought would be worth putting into action. And then instead of going home and being like, let me think about this for 7 months, mm-hmm. you just started doing it. Mm-hmm. And it changed the way that people are engaging with you on social media.
I was talking with a friend, and that's one thing that I've also been doing, trying to do a lot more, is just stuff like this, like conversations. Because like when I visited you and I just left ton of notes, stuff that we talked about, stuff that was jogging my brain. Whenever I come out of a conversation with a colleague, I usually have stuff that maybe they said and they don't even know it, that just jogged my brain. And now I can't stop thinking about it, and I just obsess over it. And we're talking about how a lot of people, it's so interesting how sometimes I will meet CEOs of super successful companies and they're not smarter than me. Mm-hmm. They're not smarter than me. They are just doers, and they mm-hmm. get shit done. And he had said a quote, and I forgot what it was. A focused fool can accomplish more than a distracted genius.
I like that.
Yeah. And that, I was just like, wow. And it's interesting because I know the type of leader that I am. My assistant knows the type of leader that I am. I'm an idea guy. Mm-hmm. I love ideas. But I have her, and she's great about this. She'll say, that's great. Here, these are what we're focused on. Let's put those, she calls it, in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. Those are great ideas. Let's put those in the parking lot. And she does for me what I tell other coaches and trainers to do, which is when they sit down to program a workout, everybody gets paralysis by analysis. Everybody. That's the number one thing that I think that's the number one reason why people hate programming workouts and programming phases, because they get paralysis by analysis. And that's because they focus on what's important instead of what's urgent. And now we've taken that same concept and applied it to my business. What are the three things that are going to have the biggest impact on moving the needle for my business? Let's focus on those. Mm-hmm. So right now, our social media, that was a big thing. Her and I sat down. We created a system for how I approach social media. So it is, the way I'm building my business is, have you read The E-Myth?
Yep.
Yeah. One day I'm going to sell my business. So if somebody came in, I hired a coach or somebody, I want it to be able to exist without me. And right now it can't. So that whole thing, if your business can't exist without you, you don't have a business, you have a job. Mm-hmm. Right now I have a job.
That's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And right now I want to scale it to a point where I can bring in other coaches and trainers, mentor them, and serve more people. But one thing that came out of our conversation was I need to get the system out of my head mm-hmm. and onto paper. So every time I write content, I go to my Canva and I look at my clear system, and it's pleasing to the eyes. I like to look at it, right? Like it's really cool. Like a graphic designer did it. And I know, okay, what am I doing when it comes to social media? It's great because in creating our clear client avatar, now I know what they want to see, but also what they don't want to see. So I don't need to do the voiceover videos with the trending audio. People don't give a shit about that. They think it's super cool. My ideal client thinks it's super corny. There's just a lot of stuff that I was a little uncomfortable doing that now I don't have to, because my client, my ideal avatar, they don't want to see that shit. They just want to be, and also kind of tapping into what type of coach I am. I'm taking improv classes right now. So I did that just because I'm at a point in my career where I don't really care about getting a ton, you know, a big salad of initials behind my name. Mm-hmm. I'm very particular about the education that I pursue, but I also want to make sure that I'm doing other stuff that's going to make me a better person.
So why improv?
Because
I love the choice.
Yeah. I actually just
had a client go start improv.
Yeah. So I want to become a better conversationalist. For me, I've always been really impressed with people when they are fully present in the moment. Mm-hmm. People who make you feel like this is the only place on earth they want to be in this moment. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be anywhere else. Improv to me is one of those things where it teaches you to be fully present in a conversation. And it's what I'm learning about it is it's not necessarily, you are not trying to be funny with improv. If you try to be funny, that's when you're not funny. You're actually annoying. Mm-hmm. And that's one big thing that I'm learning is sometimes your goal in a conversation is to facilitate conversation. You're not the funny guy. You're asking questions. You're making the other, they call it gifts. So if I'm an improv and I tell you, hey, Sean, well, you're a 45-year-old strength coach. I've given you a gift because now you don't have to think about who you are in the conversation of improv. You know that. Now you can tap into that. So it's just giving gifts and receiving gifts and giving gifts and receiving gifts. And I'm just learning so much because I'm also not good at it in any way, shape, or form. I'm a good coach. I know how to communicate. But in this setting, you're screaming. You're acting like a monster. You're doing stuff that you would think like little kids do. But at the same time, you're a complete beginner and you get to see other people who are actually really good at it. And for me, in conversations, I can sometimes feel a little awkward if there's a pause. So I'll try and fill that pause. In improv, they teach you to lean into it. Don't just say something to say something. Lean into it. And sometimes that stuff where you let the pause happen for a few seconds and then whatever you end up saying following that ends up being actually funny because you're actually thinking about what you're trying to say. It's not about being witty. It's not about being the first person. It's not about first person to speak. It's not about being the, and I went to an improv show last week. Somebody that was in an improv show kept on trying to be the star of the show. And I found it really annoying. I was really annoyed by them.
I also find, so I want to come back to improv in a second, but I find that when there's a pause in the conversation, the person who doesn't break it often is the person with the power. Mm-hmm. Like there's a level of the other person breaks the pause and there's almost like a submission of, okay, you were able to handle that and I wasn't. Mm-hmm. That I've experienced in that pause. What I've learned, I don't think it was through improv because I haven't really done formal improv. I've done very little. But what improv did that I saw that was really valuable was it forces you to listen. It builds this, like, the skill of listening. Where I've seen improv lack value for people afterwards is they don't actually just, like, remove the improv of improv in real world, and they're still an improv. Where the whole idea is, no. You heard something because you were listening. You weren't thinking of what you were going to say next that somebody else wouldn't have heard. Your job now is to ask the question about the thing that nobody else asks the question about because nobody else was paying attention the way that you were. Mm-hmm. I find that to be the way to execute on improv to make people feel like they're the only person in the room.
I feel like it comes down to that whole listen to understand instead of listening to reply.
Yeah. It's the people who've always made me feel like I'm the only person in the room and like this is the only place they want to be are the people who meander in me. So they'll ask a question. I'll answer the question. And then they'll ask a follow-up about my answer. I'll answer. They'll ask a follow-up about the origins of my answer to that. And I'm like, wow, this person is really interested in me. Whether they are or not is another story. I think it's difficult to do it really well and not actually care. But I think improv is a great way to learn that.
While you were saying, people love talking about ourselves. Uh-huh. And it's funny in that you can like a person simply because they were just very interested in you. Mm-hmm. They were just very interested in getting to learn who you are as a human being, which sometimes, you know, I lived in LA for 8 years. It can be hard, and it's who do you know? What's your job? How do you make, or how much money do you make? Sorry.
It's really that basic.
LA can be extremely materialistic.
And New York is not the same. Like I'm asking, because people who don't know, you spent 8 years living in LA. Mm-hmm. Is that when you were with Tonal?
No.
Okay.
No. I was.
Oh, that's Equinox.
So in LA, I started off at Equinox, then interned at UCLA.
Okay.
And then went out on my own, moved to Denver for a year, was with Tonal during that time, and then moved to New York City, was with Tonal for a little bit of that time. And then now I've just been on my own.
Right.
Yeah.
And you moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn.
Yeah. So
you
moved from
you were looking for quiet.
Yeah. Manhattan was too overwhelming. It was too much for me. It was too much stimuli. And it's interesting because Denver was not enough stimuli. It was just too slow. Neither my girlfriend nor I were ready for that kind of slowness.
Where's she from?
She's from Pittsburgh.
Okay.
We met in LA.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was she out there for?
So she got a job out there. Okay. She got a job out there after as a lighting designer or a lighting architect. Her master's was in lighting architecture from Penn State. Mm-hmm. So she trained with a boxing trainer out there. And they were the gym that I train clients out of. It was the same gym. Mm-hmm. And they did a capture the flag tournament. And I was on the opposite team. And she tried to grab my flag and pulled my pants down.
Nice.
Yeah.
And she was like, damn, I need all of that.
I was like, you got to buy me a steak dinner first. Yeah. Like, yeah, you know, the stereotypical follow up, like, hey, buy me a steak dinner before you go for the goods.
Right.
But yeah, now we've been together for like 4.5 years.
That's cool. And she moves around with you, which is nice.
It's honestly, it is. It's awesome. We're very different. And before I met her, I was very much, I'm the person where find what you love and let it kill you.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say that?
I have to be passionate about everything that I do. To be honest, I'm good at making money. I could care less about stocks and investing in real estate and stuff like that. It just doesn't do anything for me. It doesn't interest me. So as I've grown, that's one thing where I know I've got to get a little better at in terms of doing stuff that I may not be passionate about, but can fulfill the life I want.
Well, you're talking about the job and the business.
Yeah.
Have you read Rich Dad Poor Dad?
In high school.
Okay. So that's the whole premise of the book. It's like, have a job, have a business. The job is what you do to make money. Mm-hmm. The business is what you do with your money, so you don't have to have your job forever. Yeah. I'm curious, why do you want to hire other coaches, and why do you think one day you want to sell your training business?
So for me, a great book, it was... Oh man, I'm trying to think. Stu had recommended it.
Stu can't read.
Yeah, I know. Stu had recommended it. It was something about small businesses, and the entire premise of the book, the primary thing that I took away from it was scale out of necessity, not necessarily out of desire. Mm-hmm. So I haven't brought in coaches yet just because it's not necessary. I very much know the kind of lifestyle that I want to live. Mm-hmm. I know in terms of, you know, how much I need to make in order to live that ideal lifestyle. But
what's included in the lifestyle?
For me, it's travel. Mm-hmm. It's also, I want to, Chris Harder, and I think you and I talked about him last time, his whole thing is when good people make good money, they do great things. Mm-hmm. So Andy Chen, Andy's gives away a shit ton of money every single year to, I think it's Volo Sports. I love that. I think he's planning on building a house or a school somewhere. For me, the way I look at it in terms of making money is I know that I'm a good person. And I know that if I have money, I'm going to do good things with it. So for me, I feel like it's more of a, and I was telling, it's interesting because I had this conversation in the terms of, I do very much believe that I was put on this planet for a reason. And part of that is to make money and do really good things with it. So it's not just about living the ideal lifestyle for me. I don't want to, my girlfriend can sit on the beach all day. That, she says I'm like a golden retriever. I have zero desire to do that. I don't know if I'll ever retire, but I know that I'll always coach in some fashion. Like, I imagine myself being 85 years old and sitting down in a chair, like, coaching people. Right.
So are you saying your girlfriend says you're soft and cuddly and nothing dangerous about you?
Yeah, far from it, right? Yeah. Far from it. That's why I have to grow the beard out I actually look my age. But for me, making money is very much I want to do good things with it. Okay. I want to make a lot of money so that I can do good things with it. A population I want to help out is single parents. It was just my mom and I till I was like 7 years old. Mm-hmm. My mom's my hero. Stepdad came in and really changed our life around. So I want to make
for the better.
So, that is a population that I very much want to help. And for me, I feel like I have a duty to, because I can and because I'm good at what I do. Mm-hmm. If I don't make money, I don't scale my business. I love helping people through fitness, but I don't feel like that's enough. And so I eventually want to scale my business so that we can start putting more of an effort into helping single parents and stuff like that. Like, that is a big thing. Besides living my ideal lifestyle. Like, selfishly, yes, I want nice things I like nice things.
What you're describing is uncommon amongst fitness professionals. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious where you think that got shaped. Because oftentimes when you talk to people, probably nobody's ever been on this podcast, but people who are in the fitness world, they're like, it's not about the money. Like, it's really not. I would do this for free. I'm like, well, then why don't you? And that's the end of the conversation. Well, I can't. Well, then why don't you make a lot of money doing it? Well, because it's not about the money, but it sounds like you're making it about the money. Because I'm just asking you, why don't you make a lot? And you're saying it's not about it. I'm not saying anything except why don't you make more?
Yeah.
So it's not common amongst people in fitness to want to make a lot of money for whatever reason. How do you think your desire for it was shaped?
I think people's relationship with money is shit. I think people look at money as greed and they think because that's how we grew up. I grew up in the South. It's interesting that the people who say in North Carolina.
Okay.
So after I was Reno, Nevada till I was about 7 years old.
You've been everywhere, man.
Yeah, Reno, Nevada till I was about 7 years old, and then for the most part grew up in North Carolina. And it's always interesting in that the people who say money is evil or I don't care about money are usually broke. Mm-hmm. Just plain.
Which is sad.
Yeah, they're usually broke. They don't realize how money can be leveraged. And again, Chris Harder had a really big impact on me in the terms of, when good people make good money, they do great things. And that's the way I look at it, is I see, the CEO of Patagonia gave his entire fortune away? Or I don't know if
he gave it all away.
Yeah, but he gave a good, yeah, he gave a lot of it away. Little things like that. Like, what is so bad about wanting to make money and live and be able to afford to do the things you want to do? Because when I was, so from 0 to 7 years old, my mom and I lived in government housing. So I've just seen some things that nobody should ever see. It's why I've been going to therapy every week for the past 6 months. It's funny that at 34 years old, I'm still dealing with stuff that I saw then. And for me, I know what my mom went through. I know what it's like to only be able to afford a $2 bag of Goodwill Ziploc toys for Christmas. I know what it's like to be broke. I know what it's like. That is stuck with me. That stuff is just burned in my brain. And I don't want to live that life. I don't want to struggle. I want to know that I can pay my bills and that I can do the things I want to do without stressing, but also that I can help other people in the process.
So I have a question for you there. I have a lot of questions for you there. One is, when you were a kid and you got a bag of Goodwill toys that, you know, that your mom bought now that you know for $2, did you know the difference?
No. To me, I specifically remember, and I tell people this, we'd be in Goodwill and I'd be begging my mom. So they had $1, $2, and $3 bags. $3 bags had more toys. I would be begging my mom for a bag of a bag of toys, and sometimes we would get it and sometimes I wouldn't. But at the time, I had no idea. That's just what I knew.
So on Christmas morning, it wasn't for you. It wasn't like other kids are getting something like this is.
No. And because we did live in, we're in government housing in Reno. So we were an extremely, you know, we had all four tires on our car on bricks and the windows kicked out. So one Christmas, we didn't have a Christmas because they stole everything out of my mom's car and she was going to put it under the tree. So there's just, I remember like we would get stop and get McDonald's and my mom wouldn't get something. Be like, why aren't you getting anything? I'm not hungry. It's because we couldn't afford it. The most we could afford was like a $2 or $3 bag of a Happy Meal. Like we were broke, seriously, seriously broke. So I still have a lot of that stuff. And what's cool is that my mom met my stepdad, and for the most part, I had a really fucking awesome life. Like I really did. I was really fortunate. We moved to North Carolina, and I was middle class. Like we, you know, if I had the nice bats like and the that. Nice cleats and, it was neither of my parents went to college. My dad, was a mechanic and a race car driver and my mom didn't go to college. She was an accountant. It was just sheer working their asses off.
Well, so the reason somebody would say the reason that a fitness professional would say something negative about money, the reason they would have that oh, it's bad, is because they want their services to be accessible to everybody. And they feel their own version of what you felt when you were a kid. And they want to be the person who comes in and saves the day. Whether they want to think of it that way or not, that's what it is. You want to save the day for somebody who couldn't afford to work with somebody else. And you don't want your stuff to be inaccessible financially to the person who can't afford it. So what ends up happening is you end up deciding who's insignificant enough to price out and you don't make enough money doing it. So you end up doing something else for a living, training on the side, convincing yourself you're really good at it, not getting your clients the results that they really deserve or need to get. So they're not making the referrals. So you don't see yourself as valuable enough. And everybody you talk to says no one's going to pay that much money because everyone you're talking to can't afford to pay that much money. That's one way you could have gone. Why do you think you went the other way? Because, I mean, what you're doing is you're effectively pricing out your mom.
Yeah, yeah. For me, and somebody said this, and I've always, ever since they said it years ago, I believed it. Fitness is a luxury, and that's unfortunate. For the most part, I do believe fitness is a luxury.
Fitness or fitness coaching?
Fitness coaching.
Okay.
Fitness coaching is a luxury, but it's multifaceted. It's a lack of education. You know, it's a lack of access to quality coaches. But for me, and this is something that my assistant and I are constantly thinking, okay, I'm a damn good coach. I'm going to charge my worth because I know if I don't charge my worth, I'm going to end up resenting the people that I'm undercharging. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to want to go to those sessions. I'm not going to enjoy those sessions because, hey, I'm going to be completely honest. When I've made a lot of money, I've also been really freaking happy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm able to show up as a better version of myself for my clients. The way that we've done it, I'm taking it from a colleague, Erin, and she's in she's a therapist. For example, we are going to do, it's just like a business. You have different entry points. You have your smallest offer, and that's much more accessible. Maybe it's an ebook. You have your next tiered offer, so maybe that's group coaching for $75 a month, and then you have your premium offer. One thing that we are constantly thinking about is how can I serve? How can I get my worth? How can I charge my worth? So serve these people, the top 10% of the country. How can I serve them? But then find a way to again take what we have garnered in terms of gross income or whatever it may be, and now let's funnel that back to the people who might not be able to afford coaching. So I just think people give up. They don't look hard enough into the problem. You can serve these people. You can charge your worth. And if you want to serve these people down here, then find a way to do it while still being able to charge your worth and not resenting the people who aren't, because it's not their fault that you're not charging your worth. It's your fault, mm-hmm. right? Like, you need to improve your relationship with money. And the idea that, and that's something that kind of Chris taught me very much. So, you know, me being able to say, okay, if I make this much, maybe we can, that if we make this much and we donate this much, the more money I make, the more money I can donate. If we're thinking about a percentage of our gross income or whatever that is, then that means the more money I can donate. Or maybe it's one of those things where, like, we're coming out with an ebook. The ebook, and I took, this was an idea I took from Aaron, who's a therapist, is we're going to do pay what you can. Pay what you can. That is, that it's my first ebook that I'm going to offer. It's going to be pay what you can. So we're going to have a suggested price, but it's,
why put a suggested price?
So that's, it's something just so we can communicate the value. And that's something that we've gone back and forth about is,
I think it'd be interesting to
price.
Look, I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah.
I think it'd be interesting to not communicate what you think it's worth
and see what people.
Yeah. I remember I was, one of the things I've spent a lot of time doing is opting into things mm-hmm. because I just want to see how their funnel works.
Yeah.
And from people I really like to people I really don't like, I just want to know how things work because I want to be able to speak from a place of knowledge and take from them what's good and leave from them what's not. And I remember this guy had an opt-in and you just send a DM or no, you just comment on his post. Then they automatically sent you a DM. Then the DM was AI and it got you to, okay, this is, it, like, based on the questions that you answered, it sounds like these are the three things that you would need. Yeah. And then you said, yes. It said, great. Here's a link to go get them. You go to the link and it says, hey, how much do you think these are worth? And then there's a slider or like you could type in the number or slide a bar. And I just typed in $1 because I'm like, I'm whatever. I just want to just give me the thing. I thought it was gonna be free. And then it took me to a checkout page for $1. I didn't buy it, not because I didn't think it was worth a dollar, but because I had gotten what I wanted already. But I thought that was fascinating. I'm like, I wonder what people are writing here.
There's a book, I don't remember what it's talking about, but with the pay what you can method, what they found, it was a magazine, the case study was going over a magazine that was going out of business. Mm-hmm. Said, hey, let's try this. Instead of charging people this set amount a month, pay what you can. They choose how much they pay for the subscription. And what studies have found is that it ends up being about the same because you get the societal pressure of I can afford to pay $20 for this, or I can afford to pay X amount of this, while still at the same time, again, serving the people who might not be able to afford it.
You can split test it.
Yeah. And that's something because she does, and it's hard to do this in our line of work. Hers is pay what you can, pay if you can. I think it's pay what you can and pay if you can are her two things. And she has her set for her one-on-one clients. I want to say, I could be butchering this, that she has her set price. Mm-hmm. And then for 10 slots, she has pay what you can and pay if you can. And that's like an interesting concept that allows you to, you know, and this is something else that we've thought about. I've seen companies do that. We've thought about doing is once I get to a point with my one-on-one online coaching business, when we begin to expand to maybe online group coaching, right now we're just focused on one-on-one online coaching. We're blinders on. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we can do a thing where it's like pay for a friend? So you pay two memberships and we find a way to somehow give access. That's another thing that I'm always thinking is, how can I charge my worth while still serving people who might not be able to have access to that high quality coaching?
That's the Italian coffee model. When you buy a cup of coffee in Italy, you pay for two.
Okay.
So if someone comes over and they can't afford a cup of coffee, the guy can just give them a cup of coffee. A way that I feel like you could do that if you wanted to is, and here's the, you could allow people to pay for two, Or you could just charge enough and then go work with a charity that you like, who you don't have to now vet the people coming through, mm-hmm. and you can just give to them. Mm-hmm. There's a charity, I don't know if they should call it a charity. It's a not-for-profit that men's and women's health are popping up right now, called Strength and Diversity. And they asked me to come be a mentor for the group, which is cool. And what they do is they don't give handouts. They give mentorship to people from impoverished communities mm-hmm. who don't have a role model who could teach them how to do what they're trying to do. So these people, they can't afford it. They just got out of prison. They came from a family with nothing. They grew up in a neighborhood that whatever. And they're not giving them anything except the mentorship tools so that they can now put in the work that's required without having to figure out what work is required. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they choose who gets into it, but that's an example of, on the professional development side, I can give without having to, like, we make enough money mm-hmm. that I can give some of my attention over there. Mm-hmm. It might be simpler for you to just start with something like that.
And I like that. I like that idea because, again, it's just... everybody, I think we've probably all done, I don't know if you have done the where you get like 20, 30 people to line up on a line and they have you step forward, you know, take a step forward if you're a male, mm-hmm. take a step forward if you're white, yeah. take a step, right? And I've done that a few times. And a lot of it is just, okay, you know what? Like you look and you kind of see like I'm at the very front. What can I do to help other people? Because not everybody has the same access. Some people start much further back. So how can you open that door a little more for other people?
What I always find interesting about that is the person who is asking the questions for the step forward is dictating what they believe to be privilege.
And I've always wondered if it's a set questions.
Even if it is, somebody made them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, like the second question you ask is step forward if you're white. Mm-hmm. There's something in there. There's someone said like, oh, that's, but 6-year-old you, mm-hmm. if nothing changed, now that's 21-year-old you, mm-hmm. how much privilege do you feel like you have?
In the end, I would say it's one of those answers where it's like, it depends almost.
Of course.
Yeah. It depends. It's one of those answers. It's one of those where you just have to think about so many different.
Well, you had a great mom.
Yeah.
Right, so it's like, well, that's a privilege. I find that kind of stuff interesting.
Yeah,
I love diving into the weeds on that with people who are really strong beliefs.
Yeah,
tightly held. I'm like, let's see if we can loosen that hold a little bit.
And what was the book when it comes to debating? I forgot what it was saying, but it's the primary thing was when you are debating, you're not looking to change someone's opinion. You're just getting them to rethink their own. And if you can get somebody to rethink their own beliefs, then you've done your job. And that's something that I feel like a lot of, and myself included, I forget that at times when you're debating is, hey, you're not looking, they're probably, especially if they're really passionate about it, they're probably not going to change their beliefs at that time, but they might rethink what they believe and later down the line end up. That happened to me a couple of years ago with flexibility. I had somebody who really challenged me on a post, and we got into it, right? And I was like, dude, fuck you, you're an idiot. And whenever somebody is that passionate about something, I usually will do a little research. Like, all right, is this just some person, like,
right,
you know, who's not even a coach or trainer, has never trained anybody, or is this somebody that's actually worth a damn? And his posts were actually like, okay.
Did this person give you 4 different versions of flexibility?
Yeah.
I think the same guy came to me.
Yeah, flexibility, flexibility. He pointed me to flexibility research. Mm-hmm. I forgot what his name is, but it was like active, yep. active and pat. Yeah, and I that eventually
was
led
this
me,
post about when you were going through our education?
Might have been.
Because I feel like the same guy came
honestly,
to me.
It
and
might
I was like,
have,
you know what? There's some merit to this.
Honestly, it might have been because he eventually, I took flexibility research. I took his course and he his thing is interesting. And he says, you know, his whole thing is like, we use mobility completely wrong. Like the word mobility just refers to not moving in varying directions, but how far you can move in one direction. And he had an email that came the other day, and that's where it comes to this very interesting thing. Like, okay, well, I get that we think about mobility in the literature, it's defined as this, right? Like directions, degrees of freedom in one direction, not multiple directions. But the general public now knows mobility as this. So do we need to evolve our definition? Mm-hmm. And if the goal is to move the needle for general population and athletes, our whole thing is talking to them in a language they can understand. So am I going to make them understand my language because the literature says this? Or am I just going to say, hey, you know what? It started off as this. Probably need to evolve our definition.
Yeah.
And even and
it's
even
that, by the way.
Yeah.
It's the same as when someone says, I want to get toned. Mm-hmm. And the trainer who's like, there's no such thing as tone. It's like, well, you just lost a client.
Yeah.
Like, there was no reason.
Why'd you have to be a know-it-all dickhead?
Right.
Like, you know exactly what the fuck they were saying, man. I absolutely cannot stand that. The whole tone thing, and this is where I find that the trainers and the coaches that get super passionate about toned are also the ones that don't understand shit about branding or marketing.
Right. Because they're not thinking about their client. They're thinking about their own edification.
Yeah. And that gets really frustrating because they couldn't even tell you what the difference between branding and marketing is. Mm-hmm. They have no idea how the two are different. And they've never taken a course on branding. They've never taken a course on marketing. They just know strictly fitness. Yep. And they are so ingrained into that, which is usually those are the people who they're not making that great of money.
We were talking about it this morning about we have some clients we developed through our ALP who are doing $10,000, $12,000, even $15,000 a month on an average. And we have some trainers coming through it who are doing $3,000 to $5,000. And the question is, what is the predictable thing that enables a person to make $12,000 to $15,000 a month when they came in making $3,000 to $4,000 that is not present or that is present? When the alternative exists, either they don't have it or they do have it, whichever one is not valuable, they struggle to get past $5,000 a month. And what we're starting to land on, I think, is it's somebody starts to believe, I have the technical skills. I need to keep getting better at them. And I have the technical skills to help a very specific audience of people. What I'm missing most is the communication skills to describe who I am, what I believe in, to understand how they want to be spoken to. And it's the people who are able to dissociate for a moment from needing technical skills so deeply to needing interpersonal skills deeply and then applying them as they get them. That's the separator. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're describing when you're talking about brand. A brand to me, I know Boris would probably have something to say about this, but a brand to me is just the core values that dictate the mission that we're on. It's, hey, this is the mission. These are the values. The mission is where we're going. The values are how we're getting there. That's the brand. Those are promises. That's it. Mm-hmm. How you communicate that allows someone to either know or not know who you are and what you stand for.
Yeah. I forgot who said it, but somebody... It was branding. Marketing is what you tell people you are. Branding is what people say you are when you're not in the room.
I like that.
Yeah. And I was like, so just so simple. Mm-hmm. And I'm obsessed with how people receive information, but also how I communicate information. Like that stuff really, because to me, the best coaches are typically the best communicators. Mm-hmm. They know that sometimes the best cue is to say nothing at all. Little things like that. How can you set the client up for success? If it can be said in two words, don't say it in four, not throwing 10,000 cues at. And I've noticed that all the best coaches that I know are really freaking good communicators. But the ones who maybe I see clear areas of development, they have a strong appeal to authority on Instagram. It's using the overcomplicated language. It's assuming they also, what I find is they don't know. They don't actually have a clear idea of what their client knows and what their client doesn't know.
Well, what are some things you've done to practice queuing as a for example. Like I'll give you some simple examples. One of the things that we use as a construct at Active Life is tell, show, do. Tell me what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Show me what it looks like. Then let me do it. Mm-hmm. Then what comes up is what's the nuance within the tell? How much are you talking about? And we just before I came here, we were doing a trainer development. And it was, I want you to teach this person an RDL as if they were on the phone with you.
So that was going to be my next thing, is one of the things that I wanted, that I challenged myself to do at a certain point in my career, was teach them the movement without actually showing them the movement. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing. Can I cue them into a good position? It's just like with assessments. With assessments, you don't want to show them how to do it, because right. then they'll do it. Yep. That's right, the problem with FMS. So that was something I challenged myself to do early on in my career, is on occasion, not all the time, is can I teach this client to do what exactly what I want them to do without showing them what it looks like? And then from there, something I love doing is manipulating the setup of the exercise to drive intent. So RDLs, that's a really hard movement. What about if we just did a bench reference, like a tactile cue, and just had to put a bench behind their calves and told them to keep, hey, just keep your calves pressing into the bench. Pretty easy. Skater squats. Hey, their back foot keeps touching. Okay, put a lacrosse ball behind their knee. Ball slams. They're not throwing it down hard enough. They're not giving me any intent. Put them on a box. They're going to have to slam the ball hard in order to make sure that they can catch the ball at the bottom. Uh-huh. So for me, I'm always thinking about the minimal cues. I'm not so much thinking about, everybody loves getting into internal, external cues and when you should use this and when you should use that. Just use the best cue. Use the one that works. Adopt your communication style to the IQ of the client, what they know, what they don't know. If they know, internal rotation, okay, use that. Like, you'll get an idea of knowing what they best respond to, but also just being able to manipulate the setup of the exercise in order to drive the intent, especially when it comes to fitness, because intensity drives adaptation. We want to get them to train hard. And I would argue that the problem is we pretend that people train too hard, but anybody that's worked with Gen Bop for an extended period of time knows that the people that you have to pull back are usually the exception. It's the people, most people you got to push. Most people don't train hard enough.
I think that depends on the environment.
Yes.
So the one challenge I'll throw out here is I think, for example, in CrossFit,
yes,
it's not about that they work too hard. They're not getting, you're right about the lack of intensity that they think they're getting as compared to what they're actually getting. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you weren't supposed to be able to stand right now. Mm-hmm. You didn't do that. But they do so many reps at 85 to 90% of the intended intensity that I just see it like, you don't need to do so much. You can do less. In fact, you should do less. The more you, like, that's a 1 or 2 day a week kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
So, two thoughts. I always tell coaches and trainers, start managing expectations for your clients. You should leave this workout feeling like you could do more.
Right.
Okay. So when they do that week one, if you're doing like a linear periodization scheme or whatever it may be, like, manage the expectations. Hey, you should leave this workout in a body bag. Okay, cool. I know I'm going to have to really put it into this workout. But if you tell them you should leave this workout feeling like you could do more, they're not expecting this workout to put them in a body bag, and they're not going to start questioning you for why the workout wasn't super challenging. That comes down to their education and what their expectations are around what do they believe is a good workout. Like, what are the emotional feelings, which I don't think we think about enough? What are the cues that they think about that says, hey, I had a good, effective, successful workout. This workout moved the needle for me.
I like that. It's whenever I get into a meeting with a mentee, or a prospect who's thinking about buying, the meetings start with what would make today successful. Forget about if you buy, forget about any of that, because it's really not the most important thing to me. The most important thing to me is that when this meeting is over, you would tell all of your friends they should get on a call with me. Because if you end up not being a client, and I didn't even try to sell you, and you shouldn't have bought, you're going to tell 20 people, hey, he connected me to somebody else who I couldn't have gotten access to because he thought I should buy from them instead of him. Mm-hmm. You should talk to him.
I've done that for when I moved from LA. I will, if somebody reaches out to me like, hey, I need a coach in LA, or hey, are you still in LA? Because I will get those. I connect them with coaches that I know in LA. Like, I will do everything I can, not just going to, even when, so when I left LA, I had a few clients who they weren't going to do online coaching. They didn't want to do virtual, but I wanted to make sure that they were still in good hands. So I set them up with, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Tim Caron. He owns, he's the former head strength coach of Army football, and he owns Allegiant. Co-founder of Allegiant Group Fitness. So it is a group fitness. They are strength training always. They are strength over conditioning. They brought the Division One weight room mentality to Gen Pop. So he is big on tempo. He's, to me, he's the program design god. There's just nobody that thinks about program design to the level that he does, and he's somebody who I've taken a lot from. I knew their approach. I knew very much that they believed strongly in FRC approach to mobility and flexibility in terms of pails, rails, cars, stuff like that. So a few months before I moved, I started slowly integrating that stuff into my clients' routine. And they were able to very seamlessly transition from one-on-one with me, and I think I gave them three or four clients, to group fitness. Mm. And I had already been able to create the buy-in for this approach because I did believe in it. And they're still members at Allegiant. And, you know, to the, cause you were talking about CrossFit. CrossFit is the epitome. And where I think this applies is train as hard as you need to, not as hard as you can, unless as hard as you need to is as hard as you can. That's, you know, strong as you need to be, not as you can be. Like, how hard do you actually have to train in order to move the needle? Because when we know how hard we need to train, then we know the time and effort that we need to put into different boxes. So I know that, you know what, my strength on my squat is good, but my squat is stronger than my deadlift, and my deadlift should probably be stronger, so I should focus on my deadlift. Or I've got a pretty good, you know, basis of strength right now. I could probably afford to put more time into my mobility and flexibility. I think coaches, and I think you and I had this conversation, coaches focus so much on strength because it's easy and it's what they're good at.
It's lazy.
But they don't know how to develop conditioning. They don't know how to develop mobility. And a big thing, something I took from UCLA, was a needs analysis. Just do a needs analysis for every single client. Like, your assessment should tell you what they need. What are the things that are most, the top three things that are most urgent that are actually going to move the needle? And I've had this conversation with a ton of coaches and trainers who, and it's a typical thing. Somebody comes to you, they want to lose 20, 30 pounds, but you notice that they're lacking some hip IR or something. Next thing you know, they're doing 20, 30 minutes of pails, rails, or whatever it may be. One, what's to say that just losing 30 pounds won't improve their hip internal rotation? Two, you have not created the buy-in. You've just assumed that they're going to trust you, and now it's been 3 months later, and they haven't lost any weight because you've been trying to address something that was important, but it wasn't urgent. What was urgent was them losing 30 pounds. What you could have done, focus on them losing 30 pounds, made the workout actually move the needle. Once they've done that, now they trust you. Now they believe in you. Now let's work on the hip IR. But was the hip IR really that big of a deal? Like, how drastic was it to where you needed to dedicate 20, 30 minutes to addressing it?
Mm-hmm. That's commonplace. So with that mindset, how do you ever refer to group fitness? Because most group fitness is not going to do a needs analysis. They're like, what you need is what I do. How do you do that?
It's all about, people like group fitness. They like doing F45. They like doing berries. So I hate when coaches come in and say, you need to stop doing this. Mm-hmm. You need to stop playing basketball. You need to stop running. No, find the lowest entry point possible and allow them to do whatever that is. Allow them to do the things that they love. So for me, what I will encourage, and I just signed an online coaching client the other day. She's trying to make an NFL team as a cheerleader.
Okay. say that's
she's the
uphill climb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. She's trying to make an NFL team as a cheerleader, and she trains her ass off. But something she learned last year is, like, she wasn't taking any off days. She is one of those people that you have to pull her back, and she loves doing group fitness. She loves Barry's. She really enjoys it. So for me, it's how can I create a program that allows you to still do the things that you love?
Right.
You know what? And I do this for a lot of clients. You could train 4 days with me, or you could train 3 days with me. Why don't you train 3 days with me and do 1 day at Barry's every single Saturday?
Does the price change?
Does the price change?
Yeah.
No, because we just changed our price. I just changed my pricing.
I like it.
Yeah. So we have coaching and programming, and just programming only.
They're buying the solution. It doesn't matter how many days a week they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I've always, and I'm not to say I've done that. When I was younger, I did that. Like, hey, you're going to need to stop this. Or then you get a little smarter and you realize, like, man, there's almost always a way to keep people doing the things that they love. Now, it is obviously a little different when we need to maybe avoid cyclical activities because they're, you know, stuff like that. But for what I am always aiming to do is, how can I keep you doing the things you love? Or how can I maybe put some constraints on to make sure that you can still do the things you love, but it's not going to prolong the time, especially if somebody's in pain or they're suffering from an injury or something like that. How can I put some constraints on to keep you doing the things that you love without prolonging the time that it's going to take you to get back to baseline?
So who is your ideal client? People listening right now, maybe they're like, hey, I like this Josh Clay guy.
Yeah. So for me, it's usually people who are around 24 to 39 years old. Maybe they play college athletics.
24 to 39. That's a range.
24 to 39 years old, man.
It's an interesting group right there.
I will be completely honest. I don't like working with older people.
Okay.
I don't like working with older people.
So I'm 40. I'm an older person.
You're good, man. Yeah. We can't do a hard cutoff at 39. Yeah. No, I would say, so it's busy professionals.
Why? My favorite thing to do with people on Instagram when they come to me and whatever, I'm like, you have busy professionals in your profile. That's cool. So are you saying my dad, who's 70, who's retired, who's not busy, he'll tell you he's busy, he's not busy, you wouldn't take his money if he wanted to work with you? And they're like, no, of course I would. And I'm like, well, then why do you have busy professionals in your profile? And typically, for most people, it's because they want someone who's making money. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious.
So for us, busy professionals is usually they're logical people. They're to a degree. Obviously, we know people aren't always logical. Right. But usually there's a certain level of drive there. With busy professionals, usually what they are wanting from a training standpoint is these are generally going to be people who do have a fitness routine, but it might be at the point where they've taken themselves as far as they can go. They want somebody, they know there's a better way, but time, they value their time in the gym. If they are there, this is a whole, like, hard work for hard work's sake is just work. If they are there, it's for a very specific reason. They want to make sure that their workout is moving the needle. So a lot of times it's thinking about, for us or for me, what are the common traits of a busy professional? That's what I'm thinking. And can I encompass that into one word? Because a big thing with brands, right, is like part of branding is saying who you're for, but also saying who you're not for. Yeah. So it's not to say that I wouldn't work with those people, but I do want to niche down to a degree and talk to a very specific type of person.
You want people who are time sensitive doers, mm-hmm. who are outcome oriented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not going to, it is not my job to convince you that this is worth it, mm-hmm. to a degree. Mm-hmm. I want people who already, they value fitness. They believe in strength training. They believe in guidance or whatever that is. Those are the people that I want to attract. Not to say that I'm not for, you know, maybe somebody else that could afford the training or whatever it may be. It's just I want to speak to a very specific type of person, and I'm also looking at the qualities that those people tend to have.
What's the goal you like to help people work towards? Like if I came to you and I was like, hey, I want to lose 200 pounds. Or I came to you and I said, hey, I want to be able to pick up basketball with my friends and not get tired and actually start outrunning them. Like, where do you live on that spectrum?
I would say I definitely have more of a performance-based approach to fitness. So it's creating people who are strong, resilient, and capable. I actually have a pro card in bodybuilding. So I was a WBFF pro fitness model.
Sawson?
No, I wasn't.
Wow. You got a pro card without the juice.
Yeah, I was the youngest. I was the youngest fitness model at the time. Yeah, all I was right. the youngest fitness model
did
at the time.
Did that ever pay anything to you?
I was actually very fortunate. That did not pay, but I did get, and it wasn't a lot of people at the time. I got my pro card back in 2013, maybe. People would sign like a contract with a supplement company and they would get $150 in wholesale. And they'd be like, I'm sponsored. You're not sponsored.
Right.
I did have an actual sponsorship with OEI Nutrition. So I was in a lot of their ads, but then, I got paid. They paid for all my competition fees for my competitions. When we went to the Arnold and stuff like that, I got paid. They covered all my expenses. So that was actually a really cool thing. Mm-hmm. When I think about it, I was fortunate because I was in Charlotte and they were a Charlotte-based company. But there were definitely people who were much more maybe jacked than me, maybe whatever. I'm not sure what they saw in me. I'm very blessed by it. They are no longer around. I actually don't think they're around. Their claim to fame was trying to create a bar that competed with Quest. Mm. So they created the One Bar.
I remember that bar.
Yeah. So they created that. So in college, it was really cool because I had...
You were loaded with
Oh, I had every supplement known to man. I had all the pre-workout, all the protein bars. Like, it looked like a vitamin shop inside my room. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty cool, to mm-hmm. be honest. And I was talking with my girlfriend the other day, and I have had my hand in many different honeypots throughout the fitness industry. I've been a trainer at a drug rehab facility. That was pretty cool. Yeah, I've been at the Division I level interning at UCLA. I've been behind the camera on Tonal, and now I can't say it yet, but I accepted a job offer with a company where I'll be an on-camera coach.
Okay.
So it's really cool because there are just, I think people, we sometimes pigeonhole ourselves in the fitness industry and just thinking you're just a trainer or you're just a coach. And that can sometimes maybe get people down because, like, I don't know if I want to be a coach or trainer for the rest of my life. But when you think about it, there's so many different client populations that you can work with. And there's so many different jobs that you can have in the fitness industry if you just network. Mm-hmm. I've gotten everywhere I am because of people I know.
I believe that.
Firmly believe. It's solely because of people I know. Mm-hmm. And this person knew that person and introduced me to that person.
They heard something was coming up and they're like, I know the guy for that.
Yeah. That's why I got the job at Tonal.
Yeah.
It's the only reason I got the job at Tonal is because a colleague was working there, a program, a position opened up. It was like, hey, you're the only human on earth I know who actually likes to design workouts. You want to come work for Tonal? I was like, you know what? This is a pretty cool opportunity. I've never thought about doing this. Let's fucking do this, man. Let's fucking do this, man. So I have a lot of different lenses, which I'm very, very blessed because especially when it comes to working out and like designing workouts, I have a post that I'm working on and my colleagues that I worked with at Tonal, Michelle and Jenna, Michelle was my boss. Jenna was the other programming specialist. They made me realize that workouts are nothing but stories. Like, but what is the story that your workout is trying to tell you? And what I find with coaches and trainers and with people in general is that nobody knows. If you look at the workout, you should know what it's doing. Like, that was something that we did at Tonal is we instilled very specific principles. When I came in, if you had 10 different people write an improved fitness routine, you were going to get 10 different principles that went into that, right? Mm-hmm. 10 different beliefs. So you didn't have a tonalified way of doing things. We came here, no. Like, we want to tap into what you believe, but what does Tonal believe? This isn't about you, we're about us. What does Tonal believe mm-hmm. when it comes to program design? So what we wanted to do is when people saw an improved fitness or a build muscle program, they knew right away. From looking at the reps, from looking at they knew right away what that workout was supposed to do. And I believe that most, what we're, really trying to do is you're trying to give people the education they need to do it on their own, but the level of service that makes them not want to. And that was, we came in, we're like, this is what we believe when it comes to building muscle. This is what we at Tonal believe when it comes to improving fitness. This is what, so it didn't matter if Jenna wrote the program or Michelle wrote the program or I wrote the program. It was Tonalified because we had a very specific way of how we built all of our templates. But Jenna and Michelle, we always had to put notes, and we would sometimes have, they were really good at creating. You always knew when I submitted a workout because I wouldn't come up with a suggested workout name. Cause that's just, I don't know, call it accumulation by power. Like I don't, I'm not good at it, man. That's just not my forte. But you would have to put in notes for the coaches. Right. And they were just so good at creating workouts, not only from a rep and from an exercise standpoint, but they were so good because Jenna has had every certification known to mankind. I mean, Les Mills, like all those types, Pilates.
So she could put the show on.
Oh, it was amazing. She was extremely impressive. And they made me realize that workouts are just, they put it really well, that workouts are just nothing but stories. And what story are you trying to tell within that workout? And I think that's a really cool framework to view program design and fitness through is when you look at your workouts as a whole, what is the story you're trying to tell? And the story being usually the quality, right? Like strength, power, building muscle, whatever that is. And when you look at the supporting details, what's the stuff that you could cut out that's maybe going to water down the story or water down the adaptation? Mm-hmm. And it's that book that I talked about where they said, where they were talking about the goal of debating isn't so much to change somebody's mind, but to make them challenge their commonly held beliefs. There, he said, 1 to 2 strong supporting points. 1 to 2 strong supporting points. Quit watering your message down with 4 to 5 kind of okay supporting points, because the person that you're debating with is just going to attack those, because those are really easy to shoot down. And now you've watered down your message.
I'll tell you what, one of the things I have found to be the most effective when I'm in a debate situation, not that I've ever done a formal debate, is I'm not actually interested in changing your beliefs at all. I'm interested to see if you can change mine. And so for me to change one of my beliefs, I have to ask you all of the questions about what you're saying that would allow me, someone who is on the opposite side of you, to say, maybe I'm missing something here. And what I find is when I do that, sometimes I do. And then I feel like I've won because I'm like, oh, wow, I'm better now than I was when I went in. And when I don't, oftentimes I find that the other person is forced to say the same thing.
I actually really like that.
It's freeing.
Yeah.
Because I'm not trying to win.
I actually really like that. Yeah, I think I'm going to take that 100%. I'm taking that, man.
I'm taking a few things from this podcast.
Yeah, that's going to be a note that I put in my phone after this podcast, because it just, like you said, it forces introspection, you to ask questions. And for me, they talk about in the book, when I ask questions, I'm trying to get them to think about their own beliefs. But when I think about asking questions, like now I can be even like, what is the information that I need in order to change my point of view? So now my questions, I don't know them, but I know myself, and right, I know what the information that I would need.
Yep.
So that's actually, it's yeah, fun. I dig that, man. Yeah. That was a little,
I got you.
Yeah. I really like that. I appreciate Perfect. That.
Snuck
yeah.
it in. Josh, where can people find you?
So Joshua Lee Clay on Instagram. So we are no longer on the We Train M&M Instagram. We're no longer doing that. But yeah, Joshua Lee Clay. Or you guys can email me at josh@wetrainmnm.com. So M as in movements, N as in Nancy, M as in muscles. So business is We Train Movements N Muscles.
Are they going to be able to find that if they go to your Instagram bio?
Yes, they are.
So just go to the Instagram bio.
Yeah, just go to the Instagram bio. Yeah.
All right. Turn pro.
Awesome.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Active Live Podcast. Please remember, give us a hand, rate it, review it wherever you listen to shows. We are on a mission to humanize the healthcare industry by professionalizing the fitness industry to empower the individual to live a life unlimited by the way that their body looks, feels, or performs. If you are inspired by that mission and want to jump on the wagon, find us anywhere. Active Life Professional on Instagram, Active Life RX on Instagram. Come to me personally at Dr. Sean Pastuch. We want to welcome you onto the train. We want you to be a part of the mission. We want to offer you the opportunity to pursue this right alongside us. We're inspired by your effort, and we hope to help you in your journey. Turn pro.